dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Ideas like the rule of law, progress, and development are part of what one of our speakers this week calls the given world, the society we've been born into and which is presented to us as a fait accompli, a track with one direction only. But this is by no means the opinion of all, and many are looking toward ancient ideas and practices as guidance toward new future directions. One of these ancient ideas with resurgent power is the concept of the commons, a form of economy brutally stamped out to create the modern world. We'll examine a few different perspectives on the commons this week. We'll begin with some presentations from a conference on the law of the commons that was held March 13, 2009 at Seattle University and sponsored by the Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. It comes to us thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio. Then we'll hear a radio adaptation of a documentary, Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, that chronicles the debasement of a society in the name of progress. We'll begin with a talk on the meaning of the commons.
Our first speaker today, Professor Louise Walcher, who is from the University of Washington. I am not going to go through anybody's massive CVs as I introduce them today, except to point out just a couple of highlights, which is to say that Professor Walcher is a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and he teaches the philosophy of language, the philosophy of law, critical legal theory, and human rights, and has done so in many parts of the world, which makes him uniquely qualified to tell us why we are doing this today. Professor Walcher?
Thank you, Stephen, and welcome to everyone. Now, the title that I have given to my portion of the program is The Meaning of the Commons. But in reality, I think the better title for this entire day-long seminar is in the plural. It's the meanings of the commons. Because what we're going to be doing today is taking the notion of the commons and looking at it from a wide variety of perspectives. Now, I'd like to make a disclaimer or a confession to you, actually, right at the beginning. I am not and do not offer myself to be an expert in any of the various material or even social aspects of what goes under the name the commons. We have distinguished speakers who are, who will be following me. So that leaves me to explain to you a little bit why I think, or what I think my contribution can be to this symposium. The thing I do, or try to do anyway, and the thing I love to do, is to think critically. For me, thinking critically is the essence of human freedom. And what I mean by thinking critically is born of my own struggles with what I will call the given world. The world that we have outside these halls, the world we've been raised in, sets limits to our imagination. These limits, these ordinary, received wisdoms, these standard ways of looking at things, makes us all into sheep in most of our daily life and makes us vulnerable to being exploited by the powerful. It makes us into subjects of the law and subjects of power in all of its forms. It makes us complicit in our own dehumanization. And especially now, when the world is confronting such a vast array of problems, from global hunger, financial panic, and global meltdown, it's important that we take an opportunity, if only these few hours today, to break the grip of the immediate, which strangles our imagination and does not allow us to think and imagine new possibilities to save this world. So my own modest contribution to today's seminar will be to initiate, but not terminate, some thinking about this thing, this concept, this social practice called the commons. And more particularly, as the program brochure puts it, I'd like to think about whether there's a multiple and recurring point of intersection amongst all of the speakers you will be hearing today. Now, let's begin our thinking together with really a historical observation, one that Peter Linebaugh, the eminent historian and author of a wonderful book on the Magna Carta and the Commons, will be more skillfully and more in more detail telling you about later today. But I'd like to set the stage by saying that the notion of the commons in the Anglophone legal tradition is rooted in a particular kind of historical memory, one that goes back to the feudal era and that took institutional form in two founding documents of the English Constitution, Magna Carta in 1215 and the Great Charter of the Forests in 1225. Now, these so-called charters of liberty are widely remembered today, but they are remembered primarily in only one of their aspects. The aspect I am referring to, that most lawyers are familiar with in this country, is the one that drew the attention of the founders of our Constitution. It's the idea that the king, the sovereign, grants people certain rights and puts certain limits on his power. And so in the famous Article 39, we find the origin of the Magna Carta, we find the origin of due process of law, for example, and the idea of habeas corpus. So what we have there is the notion of the king, anointed by God, putting limits on himself, restraining himself, and granting you rights. Forgotten, or I should say barely remembered, is the other aspect of the charters of liberty. It is the notion that the king did not grant, but confirmed certain customary practices that people had been engaging in for hundreds of years and which were under threat. I am referring in particular to the right of the people in common to make use of the forests and the rivers for grazing, for firewood, for basic economic needs, in common with others in the community. Both of these charters have extreme relevance to this forgotten tradition. And it's the story of how the tradition got forgotten that needs to be told first and foremost. Now, it seems to me that it's extremely important to draw the distinction that I have just drawn between the state or the sovereign or the king granting people rights and confirming rights that the people themselves take. In the 21st century, certainly in America, we have been beaten up so much by a positivistic conception of the law and of the state that it's hard for us to think of rights as anything other than creations of people that are more powerful than us, creations that are given to us by the powerful. But the customary rights that were confirmed in Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forests were not given by anyone. They were taken by the people, and they forced the king to confirm what they had already taken. The commons, in this sense, as Peter Linebaugh so eloquently puts it in his book, is best expressed as commoning, not a noun, but a verb. People actually expressing not a set of property relationships, but rather a form of life in which autonomy and the ability to meet basic subsistence needs was something that was in the grasp of the commoners themselves, not something that had to be given to them by a superior authority. Compare that, for example, to the idea, the widespread idea, that welfare in our society is something that is given by the state, controlled by the state, and can be taken away by the state. Now, the commons in this sense, and I want to stress this, as a matter of law, or rather legal theory, the commons in this sense was not property held in commons. This is an important point. It's that the commons in this original sense was not a tract of land or a forest that the king granted a deed to a group of people, villagers, for example, to go in and root around and satisfy their basic subsistence needs. It wasn't held in common because the very notion of property, private property, is what must be put in opposition to the commons in its original sense, in its original historical memory sense. So, commoning as a verb, I guess it's a gerund, to common, how's that? To common was to engage in a form of life in which you took your life, your subsistence, into your own hands and did not wait at the table for crumbs to drop from the powerful. This was what was confirmed in the Charter of the Forests and the Magna Carta in their forgotten or nearly forgotten dimensions. Now, the point about this, to say, I think, having stressed this, the importance of this point, is that the commoning I'm referring to common, the people that commoned, and that in some sense were confirmed in their commoning in these charters in the 13th century, their joint cultural memory enabled them to form a point of resistance to efforts to extinguish what they had done, to extinguish their form of life. And when the landed nobility in England engaged upon the process known as the enclosures, which in our terminology would be the creation of private property rights, owing their ultimate force to a grant from the king, there was a resistance possible precisely because people could remember in their lifetime or in the lifetime of their parents and grandparents a different form of living. And so perhaps Peter Linebaugh will be talking to you about the diggers, the levelers, others who resisted based upon the memory of an earlier form of life. One that, to stress it again, was predicated on the notion that commoning is a form of taking your life into your own hands, not owing your life to the king and the rights that he may or may not choose to give you. Now, I think the distinction that I've drawn between the commons and commoning goes to the very heart of my interpretation, at least, of the meaning of the commons. And its most important salience for us today in a world that is melting is its political importance. If we think of the commons as commonly owned resources, then we imagine begging government, the powerful, the technocrats, for a solution to our problems as we cower in our homes waiting for the flood to rise. On the other hand, if we think of commoning in this original sense of an ungranted, unscripted form of life, then the possibility just begins to open itself for us to freely create the future in common with one another. We are all in it together on this view, and together we can imagine a new future. There is, however, a very great problem with this distinction that I have drawn between the commons as some sort of property concept and commoning as a form of life. In the 13th century in Europe, commoning as a social practice was bred into the bones of the people. It was one of the elements of the social construction of reality that people did common. They accepted it as normal, as part of life. And so when a threat came to it, they had a memory of something to fall back on. We are in a less fortunate position because the enclosures, the marketization and globalization of this world under the notion of private property and global capitalism has eclipsed the common imagination to such a degree that we've lost contact with this earlier memory, if ever we had it. There's nothing for us to fall back on. Or to put it differently, for most people, ordinary people, the only solution they can think of to the failures of the market that are roiling us right now in so many different ways is the market. More market, different market. And so, unlike the medieval peasant or the medieval commoner, we don't have this cultural memory of a different way of being. Or at least, the average person does not in the United States. And that presents a problem. What has the market wrought? What has the unregulated, for the last 30 years, the unregulated, back to laissez-faire attitude of the market of private property wrought? This question asks us to engage in the public meaning of private property. Because private property, if we put it up in opposition to the commons as a concept, is not a private concept. It is a public concept. We are in charge of it. Human beings make their world. Human beings make the law. And they go through life reiterating and reinforcing the past and keeping it alive or changing it. The 20th century saw a slaughter of human beings and a slaughter of natural resources and a slaughter of the earth on a scale that is unprecedented in human history. The German philosopher Martin Heidegger refers to the world that we have inherited in the 21st century as a world known as standing reserve or beyond. What is standing reserve? It is a world that in our imagination consists of a collection of objects and things, including people conceived of as human resources. A collection that must be put in a warehouse, ordered technocratically, and managed by those who know better. A world in which even suffering is managed in this way. Let me refer to a recent article by Alexander Cockburn in The Nation. I found this fact particularly interesting as to the way the elite, those who have power and would like to keep it, can strangle our imagination. He referred to 1931 and a poll that was taken of the National Economic League, which was a group of elite thinkers and educated people. Now, 1931 is a bad year. This is the beginning of the Depression, and people are out of work, and the stock market is falling. And, you know, we've got problems. And they were asked, what is the most important problem facing America? And the answer they gave, actually not surprisingly, was prohibition. Prohibition needed to be repealed, and if one thinks about it functionally, the reason is obvious. If people can be allowed to go into the bars to drown their sorrows, they are less likely to man the barricades, as Cockburn says, and ask for real change. Let me be blunt. Anyone in this audience today who thinks of themselves as a human resource, or who thinks that their education consisted of or consists of investing in their human capital, is as far from the primordial notion of commoning that I've been trying to elucidate as it is possible to get. These are times of great trouble, great crisis, and, if I may use the hackneyed observation, also great opportunity. My hope is that today, these brief few hours, in conversation with one another, we can have a discussion and a shared imagination about a new form of commoning. A new form of politics from the bottom, where people get together and imagine possibilities. The signs that this is possible are all around us. Let me close my remarks by pointing out something that some of you know already. This in 1968, and it's an important point in any symposium on the commons. We must give credit where credit is due. In 1968, a professor of biology by the name of Garrett Hardin published an article in the journal Science that has had an enormous political impact, an enormous impact on social science in this country, including economics. He called it The Tragedy of the Commons. I'm going to read you what he said in brief so that we can get a sense for this critique. Picture a pasture open to all, he wrote. A herdsman grazing his animals on the land will have an incentive to add another animal to his herd, and another, and another. But this is the conclusion reached by each and every rational herdsman sharing a commons. Therein is the tragedy. Each herdsman captures all the benefit from the extra animal, but the cost of overgrazing is borne by all. This argument is the core of those who oppose the commons, or rather commoning and the idea of commoning, as a form of social ordering. But let me continue to quote that notorious left-wing magazine, The Economist. The implication, this is not me, this is The Economist. The implication of Hardin's analysis that the commons are doomed came under attack early on. When economists began to look at how systems of commonly managed resources actually worked, they found to their surprise that they often worked quite well. Swiss alpine pastures, Japanese forests, irrigation systems in Spain and the Philippines, all these were examples of commons that lasted for decades or hundreds of years. Some irrigation networks held in common were more efficiently run than the public and private systems that worked alongside of them. Though there were failures too, it seemed as if good management could stave off the tragedy. Before he died, Hardin admitted he should have called his article, quote, "The Tragedy of the Unmanaged Commons," close quote. I like to think that if I just modify the word unmanaged without eliminating it to say unimagined, that is what we are fighting against today, the tragedy of the unimagined commons. And for me, the most important meaning of the commons is not a pasture, it's not an ocean, it is the shared imagination of people in solidarity with one another confronting a world that is falling apart before our eyes. Let us engage on that noble task today, and I welcome you again and wish you have a nice day, and I'll be around here to talk to all of you if you want to later on. Thank you.
Lewis Bolcher, University of Washington Professor of Law, speaking at the Law of the Commons Conference last month.
Our next speaker is Laura Nader, who's an anthropologist and professor at UC Berkeley, who deals with central dogmas about how systems work with law, energy science, and anthropology. Her most recent book, and all of her works, by the way, deal with all cross-disciplinary, basically she's crossing all disciplinary boundaries. But particularly her last book, co-authored with Ugo Mattei, and also teaches when he is not in Italy, is teaching at UC Hastings, is Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal, the story about the dark side of the rule of law and how it has been used as a political weapon to legitimize plunder. And for those of us who have been in the practice of law for 30 years or so, we understand what our next speaker is going to be talking about.
I'm humbled to be here. I'm awed by the previous speakers. And I think I owe you an introduction to why I think the way I do, because otherwise you might not understand what I'm going to do today. Judge Cardozo once said, no matter how objective we may try to be, we must never forget the fact that we see with our own eyes. And all of us do that, no matter what culture we come from. After all, Navajo means people, meaning that the rest of the world aren't. So I want to tell you a little bit about my point of view and why this will not be a lineal talk. I came into looking at law in the West from a non-Western position. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, I went to southern Mexico, to the Oaxaca Mountains, and I studied Zapotec Indian law. This was a town that had town meetings, just like my town in Connecticut. It had a court. It spoke of its relations with the state and federal government as one of exterior relations, relaciones exteriores, because they were autonomous. And they were meant to be autonomous by the Spanish crown as a means of protecting the Indians from the mestizos. I made a film about this called To Make the Balance. That was the first film. I made a second film that was called Little Injustices. That was PBS. And that was sold to over 75 countries, interestingly enough. It was supposed to be a transition film on the Odyssey series, 1980, and when President Reagan was elected, he cut off funding for the rest of the Odyssey films, which were supposed to be about anthropologists looking at American culture. I've had, apart from the Zapotec experience, under a large grant, generous grant from the Carnegie Corporation, we did a study in the 70s and 80s on how Americans complain. And the result of that was published in a book called No Access to Law. I then followed that with a book called The Life of the Law, which brought together all of the materials that 15 of my students had collected studying law in other societies, along with the work that we had done on American law. And in the book, Life of the Law, it was the light side of the law. It was the good side of the law. It was about what happens when the subaltern plaintiff gets empowered. And of course, there were cases discussed in there, like the Woburn leukemia cases, which was described in the book Civil Action, the Buffalo Creek disaster, which was about the worst coal disaster we probably had in the United States, except maybe more recently. The subaltern plaintiff was empowered, and we saw the light side of the law and what we could do. The reason I wrote that book the way I did is because Justice Berger had in fact succeeded beyond his wildest dreams of convincing people that this was a litigious country, which in fact it is no more litigious than any Western industrial society, and starting a tort reform movement that was to decrease litigation and the wonderful part of the American legal system beyond belief in a very short time by introducing alternative dispute resolution, which started here and then was sent worldwide, interestingly, and that's part of our story in the book Plunder. Now, what got me into this whole notion of the plunder are certain people that have influenced my thinking about American law, apart from my own experience cross-culturally. There was Jerome Frank's book, Courts on Trial. I don't know how many of you have read that, but he has an interesting quote. He said, "In our trial courts today, is and ought remain too far apart. To separate ethics from the judicial process is to pervert the latter. We must ethicize the works of the courts." Very interesting thinker. Had nothing to do with what I was doing in anthropology at the time, but it came to have a lot to do. I was also influenced by Edmond Kahn, his book, The Sense of Injustice, which everybody should read and reread today, especially when there's so little compassion in the practices of law, especially in our largest law firms. He said, "Justice has been so beclouded as a concept by natural law writings that it is almost inevitable. It is almost inevitably brings to mind some ideal relation or static condition or set of perceptual standards. But the response to a real or imagined instance of injustice is something quite different. It is alive with movement and warmth in the human organism." Recently, I was invited to a conference at Yale on justice in the mirror, and it struck me that nobody at that conference, and there were many anthropologists, spoke about injustice. They were so busy speaking about the abstract justice. So Edmond Kahn, I decided we should not only reread him, we should rethink him in the context of what's happening today. And of course, the Lawyers Guild is an example of a group that does understand something about the importance of the sense of injustice. And then there's Ralph Nader, who looks at the law school curriculums, and he says, "Every profession has its own myths, totems, and taboos. In the legal system, these serve to camouflage the dependency of the legal status quo on the established power systems. Despite the reality of the legal system, the myth of equal justice moves on. The very spectrum of lawyer roles was narrowed by law schools in the design of their curriculum to meet the needs of Wall, State, and LaSalle streets. Lawyers are the first to know, but mostly they remain silent." Some years ago, I was asked by the Yale Law Journal to review a book on ethics and the practice of law. I was rather surprised to be asked. It was a book by Jeffrey Hazard. He was at Yale, I believe, at the same time. And it was the first of several symposiums on the ethics of the practicing professions. Elite lawyers and government lawyers, who constitute 10% of the profession, were there. The book, one page of narrow discussion to another. And the last page in the book, the last word in the book, money, summed up the reasons for my disappointment. The book did have a therapeutic function. The members of the bar were told they need worry not about the wide-ranging impact of their activities, but only about how to deal with their clients. A concern that dominates every page of the book, whether about fees, the adversary system, advice, conflict of interest. The book reflects the specialized professionals, practitioners' passion for technical skill, a value that seems to override what most people in this country think the purpose of the law should be, a more just society. The belief that legal ethics primarily involves the dyadic relations between lawyer and client Let me say something about the dyadic. Deborah Rose, who's a professor at Stanford, leading expert on legal ethics, wrote a book some time ago called Equal Justice Under Law. Here is an interesting quote about the legal profession. There is no other profession quite so smug and self-satisfied and at the same time quite so lacking in social obligation. Social obligation. An occasional rare soul, a Clarence Darrow, may dedicate his energies to the defense of unpopular causes and earn the supercilious disapproval of his more orthodox brethren. But these are, to use that most devastating epithet, the radicals. She goes on to point out that studies from the 60s found that the most generous firms averaged only about 5 hours of pro bono a week per attorney, less than 1% of the firm's billable time. In the 80s, surveyed lawyers averaged between 5 to 15 hours per year. Only about 5% of their work went to legal aid and indigent criminal defense. So legal ethics and the social obligations, when did that launch me into something else? I think it was not 9/11, although that was predicted by people like Chalmers Johnson. In fact, it was predicted by a CIA agent in 1964. People that go around the world doing nasty things to other people can expect to have something like that happen, right? But it wasn't that. Interestingly enough, it was Bush, President Bush, sending Paul Bremer III to Iraq to run the coalition for the provisional government. We went to Iraq, presumably, because they had weapons of mass destruction. We then found out they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So we had to have another reason to be there. We couldn't say up front it was about oil, although people made jokes that if Iraq grew broccoli, we wouldn't be there. So what was the reason given? We had to bring rule of law and democracy to Iraq. Rule of law and democracy. And there was Bremer. Interesting. I once talked about this subject at Yale and elsewhere, but at Yale, there was somebody in the audience that was one of the people who was writing the edicts for Bremer. You can all see these edicts, 100 of them. You can get them on your computer, about 1,000 pages. My librarian printed it out for me. And I said at one point, the Patriot Act was unpatriotic in my talk. And this man got absolutely livid. And he said, how can you say the Patriot Act is unpatriotic? Look at Cuba. I said, I'm not looking at Cuba. I'm looking at the United States. He turned out to be a Cuban-American lawyer sent to Iraq to write one of the 100 edicts or several of the 100 edicts for Bremer. Just a kid. Couldn't be over 30. And when I was at the World Bank and bumped into some lawyers that had written some of these edicts, I said to them, what did you think you were doing? And one of the guys looked at me and he said, my job. That's what they did in Auschwitz. My job. Someone told me to do it, so I did it. I mean, if you look at these edicts, you'll know what happened under colonialism everywhere, starting in 1492, when Columbus went to the West Indies and took a notary with him. It's called plunder. Listen to it. Order number 39. Allows for the privatization of Iraq's 200 state-owned enterprises, 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi business, national treatment of foreign firms, unrestricted tax-free remittance of all profits and other funds, 40-year ownership license. Order 40 changes the banking sector from a state-run to a market-driven system, allowing foreign banks to purchase up to 50% of Iraqi banks. Order 17 grants foreign contractors full immunity from Iraq's laws, etc., etc. Outrageous. Where are the law schools? Where are the law professors? Where are the lawyers? Where are the ethics? Ugo Mattei was my colleague. We had talked, and he had come and lectured to my class many times. He had written an article, which I read. I'd written an article, which he read. We're standing in the hall in Kroeber Hall, across from Bolt. I said, Ugo, you should turn that into a book. He stood there. He said, why don't we do it together? And I said, only if you be the lead author. It's interesting. I could not have written it. He could not have written it. I'm a Roman. He's in law and economics. I know something about the history. And we both knew a lot about the dark side of the rule of law and the uses of law for illegal purposes. Rule of law is different from rule of law ideology. All of us would agree we want rule of law, perhaps. But rule of law ideology is what the headlines were all about after the weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq. Plunder, when the rule of law is illegal. Rule of law rhetoric. It's always wrapped up in movements. First, the civilizing process. How many of you have heard of Locke and Emmerich de Vattel? Interesting. One wrote in 1698. The other wrote in 1797. Both which gave legal justification for the colonial appropriation of North and Central and South American lands. It was plunder. They stole the lands. That's how we got our agricultural lands. The Dawes Act took the land from Native Americans. This is the way in the Law of Nations it was put. The earth belongs to all mankind. All men have a natural right to inhabit it. All men have an equal right to things which have not yet come into the possession of anyone. When, therefore, a nation finds a country uninhabited and without an owner, it may lawfully take possession of it. In connection with the discovery of the New World, it is asked whether a nation may lawfully occupy any part of a vast territory in which are to be found only wandering tribes whose small number cannot populate the whole country. We are not departing from the intentions of nature when we restrict savages within narrower bounds. Justifying the take, 1797. Now what's interesting is, it's not just 1797. It's been continuous for 500 years. It's still going on in this country. Taking native lands, taking native water, justifying it through the civilizing process. Now in this book of ours, we understand that we're all complicit. So we devote a special chapter to how economists, lawyers, and anthropologists are complicit. In anthropology, we found a very highly respected theoretician, Julian Stewart, who was giving reasons why it was that the government could take the Western Shoshone, the Paiute lands, for its own. And that happened under George Bush, that they finally concluded that claim. The Paiute, a Great Basin Shoshone band, the land in question dealt with millions of acres of land acquired by the U.S. government without compensation or treaty agreement. The strategy of the government was to deny title to the Indian plaintiffs on the grounds that they were not organized societies. And it was Julian Stewart's categorization of what an organized society is that had the right to own land that was behind the take. Now what's interesting is this was brought to my attention by a Canadian anthropologist. Handed me an article when I was up in Vancouver giving a talk. You might be interested in this, he said. He had found, looking at the archives, where was Julian Stewart working when he wrote this special justification? In the Justice Department. The U.S. Justice Department. So all of us have complicit relations on these issues. Another reason given for using law for illegal purposes is modernization. You go around the world and you tell people you lack this and you lack that, including lacking schools, which is not the same as education, by the way. People have been educated long before we have schools. And in fact, what's going on now, 2 years ago I went back to Zapotec country to do a film. It's called Losing Knowledge. Losing knowledge? How did that happen? They were autonomous. They knew how to weave their own clothes when I went there. They grew their own food. They had their own soft drinks. They had land that was the commons for people who wanted to use it to grow food who didn't have land. They were autonomous. They had to be. There were no roads. They couldn't get goods in, so they produced them. Now they know how to do that. What's the reason? NAFTA. NAFTA and the road. roads are disastrous for indigenous people. What did NAFTA do? NAFTA was a trade agreement, undoubtedly written by lawyers. Passed the Congress. Nobody read it. It was too big. In fact, Nader gave a prize to somebody who would read it in the Congress. One Republican from the Southwest did, and he changed his mind. The Mexicans didn't read it either. They just signed it, according to Cuauhtemoc Cardenas. I asked them if they had. He said, no, we didn't know what we were signing. So what happened up there in Zapotec country? They bring in Midwestern corn. Mind you, this is the place where corn was invented. There are 25 or 26 different kinds of corn. And they bring in corn that's good for pigs to Zapotec country. They undersell the Indians. The lands are now lying fallow. And guess where the Indians are? Los Angeles. They come north. Oh, it's all legal. But no ethics. 5 centuries we covered of this kind of justification, civilizing mission, the modernizing mission, then the development mission. These are all shams for the most part. They're teaching Zapotec women how to use computers. Why do they need to learn how to use computers for anyway? Why should everybody learn to use computers? Actually, what's the interesting thing about this was every house, every little adobe house I went into had a computer. It did have a function. It was very important. When the Canadian mining engineers went up into that area to ask permission to mine for gold and silver, because it's full of gold and silver still, the Indians came together and they said, no, we know what you guys do around the world. We see it on a computer. We can connect. They have all kinds of networks now. Biopiracy. Right? So they're using these networks for purposes of self-protection. The latest rhetoric for rule of law is democracy. My father used to say the best way to sell democracy is to be one. The Patriot Act is unpatriotic. Where are the law professors? Somebody besides Professor Cole? Somebody beside the Guild? Somebody beside, where is Harvard, Dershowitz, Berkeley, you, totally getting away with literally murder? There should be up in arms. It's something that needs to be explained. If you had ethics courses in the curriculum that were about social responsibility and something more than the dyadic relationship, maybe. That's what critical studies was supposed to do. What happened to critical studies from Harvard and so forth? It got esoteric. It got abstract. It lost the sense of injustice that Kahn was talking about. Now, one of the things that's happening, one of the things I'm dedicating myself to more and more, is the object of reducing hubris everywhere. It's the only thing that's going to save us. We're so arrogant. And I'm just not talking about the West. The West happens to still have a lot of power. The West is on its way out, but it could be just as bad if China was on its way in. They have hubris. So I started this seminar, and I'm doing a book collection called What the Rest Think of the West. Japan, China, India, Islam. We've got schools in this country, but Americans are so ethnocentric, it's beyond belief. Ignorance beyond belief for a multicultural nation. They have no idea that Afghanistan is the most incredible example of decentralized law, successful decentralized law in terms of survival of any country in the world. They don't know anything about Afghanistan. Nobody conquers Afghanistan. They don't know anything about Iraq. And they won't know anything about Iraq when they leave. They won't even remember that we were part and parcel of killing over 1 million people in Iraq. Why do they hate us? Where's the rule of law? Where's the rhetoric? Where's the action? We came to end this book. We realized that 500 years of these examples that are not just about other countries. They're about our own. 2000, that was a coup. Electoral plunder. Where were the lawyers? It was a coup. My European friends said it was a coup. The Latin American friends said a coup. A few Americans whispered. He got away with it. And Gore led him, although Gore won. Electoral plunder. Transforming the war on terror to the war on the Bill of Rights. Very few people report on that. Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! She's the one that has all the lawyers that are working on that. Never hear it on the mainline press, hardly at all. The Bush Declaration on the judicial model being dead. When I've gone to other countries, people always ask me about the tort law, especially if I'm speaking to lawyers. They've heard about American tort laws. It's the greatest tort law in the world. And we've been destroying it. The things that we have, the vision that we've given the world, whether we've achieved it or not is another question. We've been destroying it. In our book, we talk about what happened in Argentina, the neoliberal plunder, the use of rule of law, structural adjustment programs to create debts and obligations, call options, derivatives, other kinds of speculation designed to benefit foreign elites rather than the developing nations. Of course, lawyers are involved in that kind of work, but they're just dealing with their client who asked them to write it up, set it up. In the conclusion, we realize that we don't want a world without law. Legitimacy is at stake here. Legitimacy. If people think that you can get away with it, then that's the Reagan ethic. The Reagan ethic is, if nobody calls you on it, do it. If you can get away with it, do it. And they've been doing it. And they've been getting away with it. So the question is, are we a country of law? Are we a model for other people? Interestingly enough, and I'll just say this to wind up, is that in a way we still are a model. But what is it that we are a model of? In the last chapter, we went around looking at special cases. What was going on in India? Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is the most corrupt company every time I see one of their trucks in Berkeley. Berkeley's given them a monopoly on the campus. Shocking. Destroying the underwater, water, drinking water, farming water. But the way they won was by the use of law, according to the British. They quoted the British law. Our legal system, based on English common law, includes the public trust doctrine as part of its jurisprudence. The state is the trustee of all natural resources, the public at large the beneficiary. So although there is no law specifically regulating the extraction of groundwater, the panchayat and the state are required to prevent any over-exploitation of the underground reserves. The court gave Coca-Cola a month to cease water extraction, ordered the panchayat and the state to ensure the demand was met. The struggle over Coca-Cola then spread to other areas. So you could say we've had. China, there was an interesting case. In China, there are people up in arms all the time over what rapid industrialization has done to the water, the lands, pollution, terrible. A doctor in charge of being a doctor trained under the communist regime finds that people are dying. The waters are polluted. So he happens to have seen an American movie, Aaron Brockovich. And he takes that as his model. And he goes to Beijing and he says, I want some justice. Just like the Americans got justice. He got attention. That's a model that you can say comes from our. But then there's another view. There's a law professor in Tanzania named Raisa Shivji, jurisprudential scholar. He wrote a piece. He was supposed to go to England to a conference on law, just as the U.S. started to invade Iraq. Because the British were with us, he decided to boycott. But he wrote a piece called Law's Empire and the Empire of Lawlessness, Beyond Anglo-American Law. And in that, he said, we have to rethink the Enlightenment. We have to rethink Anglo-American law. We have to develop a law for this planet that comes from using the best of all the civilizations. It was actually a very generous statement because he must have been very angry. Interestingly, this business of of the place of Western law that's being challenged today worldwide, and we should know that. We should not be like Cardozo says, no matter how objective. We must always remember we see with our own eyes. And it's interesting that one of the reviews of this book, its first sentence, starts this way. Some scholars, and I am one of them, will hold that the supremacy of the West is coming to an end. And anybody who knows anything about empires knows that they rise and fall. And the whole notion that we think that the future is going to be an extrapolation of what we've got today is foolish. That's what got us into this depression we're in. So I think Shivji is right. We have to be more humble. We have to look around the world and see what solutions we have. And we have to begin to formulate, as some people have already begun, a way to get together as a planet, not only to save the resources, but to save ourselves. And I think that regardless of what anybody could say about the dark side of law, the only hope is the light side of law that we've also talked about. Thank you very much.
Would you comment on the bailout plan that's going on, transferring wealth quickly, and what we might be able to do to get our new administration to stop it?
Everything. The answer to the last question, what you might do, everything and anything. Gore Vidal said it some time ago. This is a country where you have socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. The bailout is, I'm no specialist in this, so I know that Ugo has a lot to say on the subject, but it's very clear that it's just a deal. There are no strings attached. It's just bailout. And there's going to be more bailout and more bailout. This is going to be, the person to watch on this is Stiglitz and Krugman. They should really be, I don't know why he doesn't have them in Washington, except maybe he wanted continuity with the Clinton era. Which is what got us into this also. I mean, Clinton was no saint on the economics end of it. So it's sort of like the quote FDR when he said, make me do it. I think those of you who are activists have to get in there and make them do it. Get the right advice.
Under the other thought of resources, would you talk about water and specifically what's happening with the transfer of water as a commodity in law?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm an anthropologist, but I do know that there's a water problem. And I do know, as you probably know, what the Bolivians did about it when Bechtel went in and privatized the water. I don't believe that things like water should be privatized anywhere in the world. The things that we have to... I just can't even comprehend how that could begin to happen. There's resistance. There was resistance in California as well. And we always should resist any of that kind of privatization. It's not privatization. As my brother keeps correcting me, it's corporatization.
On that same issue, I've seen it proposed that there be an amendment to the United Nations Charter of Human Rights that guarantees a right to water. Do you think that's something that we could pursue, and how best might we go about that?
Anything that makes the corporatization of water not possible, we should try and do. There are places in the world, I mean, I can just see the scene for Zapotec country, because it's very rich in water, and the valley of Oaxaca is not rich in water. And I can just see what's going to happen, because as I said to my Zapotec friends, 500 years they didn't conquer you, but they conquered you in the last 40.